Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you, everyone. My name is Joan L., and I'm a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon Family Groups. And I'm really honored and privileged to be here tonight. You know, as Concept 4 says, participation is the key to harmony. So we in Al-Anon are participating with alcoholics tonight, and we're sending an Al-Anon speaker. And when Edna R. called me a few months ago and asked me if I would be your speaker here tonight, I said, but Edna, I spoke at CNE once before. She says, boy, but your story has changed, and we really need to hear you. So here I be. Thank you, Edna. You know I needed this, too. You know, and I want to thank the CNE convention for having me and asking me and treating me so nicely. I have a lovely room upstairs. There was a basket of fruit when I arrived today and two bottles of water. That's very special. When you go to hotels today, they put two bottles of water in your room, and then they say there's a $5 charge for each one. But this was very nice, and I really appreciate that. And then when I came down and registered and went back up to my room, and I came back, and there was two beautiful dozen of long-stemmed yellow roses in my room on my table with pussy willow sticking out of it. And I said to my friend Tina, who accompanied me up here this weekend, I said, oh, my God, this must be from my children again, because no matter where I go, they send me a gift. But it was from a very lovely friend, Jim Dara, over there, who had them sent to my room, who was one of my husband Joe's sponsees for many years. Thank you, Jim. I really appreciated that. And I know Joe sent a message to you. Thank you very much. So I'm very grateful to be here tonight, and I'm very grateful to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I must say right from the very beginning, I will be forever grateful that I married an alcoholic. I don't know about you alcoholics, but I married an alcoholic named Joel, and he treated me just fine. And we were married for 48 years. And he was in sobriety for almost 42 years, along with myself. And he took me to my first Al-Anon meeting. So I'm so grateful that I married this alcoholic. Because you know what? If I didn't have my program of Al-Anon, where would I be today? Probably home under those covers or hiding in a closet. And you know what? I don't have to do that anymore. Because I came here and I learned we all have problems, but I'm here to find solutions. And Al-Anon gives me solutions, just like Alcoholics Anonymous gives you solutions. I'm not going to go into my childhood. I grew up in the Bronx, and it was a great place to grow up. And I said, you know, I went upstairs before to my room, and I laid across the bed. They even pulled down my covers. I mean, I'm not used to this. I can get used to this very easily, you know. Pulled down my covers and looked about, and I tried to close my eyes, and I said, what will I talk about tonight? And I wanted to talk about, you know, your theme here this weekend, which was so special, our primary purpose. Well, what is my primary purpose in life? And I thought how, wow, has that changed through the years? When I got married at the age of 19, to a sailor who came into my life. The first time I went out on this blind date, there was a knock on that apartment door, and I opened the apartment door, and there was this cute sailor in a white Navy uniform with tan skin. He was half Italian, half Irish, just a little shorter than I was, but all of a sudden I slumped down because I wanted to be as short as he was. And I fell in love because there's nothing like a guy in uniform to turn a girl on. And he really turned me on, you know. And I met this guy and fell in love, and thank God the feeling was mutual. But we went down this merry road, which I thought was going to be marriage eventually, but it was the merry road of alcoholism. And, you know, he may pick up the drink, but I have the isms. And it wasn't all his fault, as I learned in Al-Anon many years later. I came into this marriage with a lot of faults, too, and a lot of character defects, and I had to learn to work on them a day at a time. And I'm so grateful that I found this program. So we went down this road of marriage, and it was very interesting. The night he proposed to me, we were dating, and I was in a wedding, a girlfriend's wedding, and I was up at the dais because I was one of the bridesmaids, and Joe was down on the floor with a group of his friends and my friends drinking. And those were the years, you know, of the beer weddings. You know, they had the pitchers of beers on the table and the bottles of bourbon, and everything was on the table. Nobody had to leave the table. You just sat there and drank all night, and he did. And I was up at the dais with that watchful eye looking, you know. And when it came time for the bride to throw the bouquet, of course I went out on the floor. Gee whiz, I was just 19, and I wanted to get married, because in those days, girls got married at 18 and 19. And I wanted to get married to this guy, and he hadn't asked me yet. He was discharged from the Navy then, and I went out, and I caught the bouquet. And then when it came time for the guy to throw the groom to throw the garter, well, Joe went out there, but he didn't catch the garter. Some other young fella caught the garter. And then they put me out on the middle of the dance floor, and this young fella's putting the garter up on my leg, pushing my gown all the way up, and he's going, and everybody's yelling, higher, higher, and I'm just sitting there enjoying this whole scene now, you know. And all of a sudden, out of the corner of my eye, I see this nice little guy come running across the room, pick the guy up off his knees, and slug him. And then, you know, the photographer's snapping pictures, and I'm embarrassed, and I said, I jump up off the chair at 19, I said, I'm never going to speak to him again, I never want to see him again, and I ran out of the wedding reception. And when I got home that night, my mom said, Joe called 6 times. I says, well, if he calls again, I says, I never want to speak to him again. And with that, the phone rang on that kitchen wall. You know, back in the 50s, we'd have one little phone on the kitchen wall with no long extension cord today. When I tell my grandchildren this story today, they don't believe about the phone. The phone is a big thing. They don't understand why I didn't have one in my pocket. And so I had to answer the phone because Mom must have been, she must have went to silent Al-Anon meetings, even though Al-Anon wasn't around then. But she says, Joan, it's your problem. You take care of it. And I answered the phone, and it was Joe, and he says, Joan, I'm so sorry that happened, but I drank one beer too many, and I'll never do that again. You're all laughing, huh? And he says, would you marry me? And you know what I said. Of course. Because I said, gee, if he marries me, this nice girl from the Bronx, after all, he was from Little Italy in Manhattan. If he marries me, I could change him. That's what all of us say when we come into Al-Anon. But I thought I could change him. But you know, it ain't so. You can only change yourself. But we went down that road, and it was a beautiful road in the beginning, you know. He stayed home for 2-3 weeks. And then he got thirsty. And he started stopping after work at night. I thought something was wrong with me. You know, I was cooking all these little dinners that my mom taught me how to cook, and always had a white apron on when he was ready to come home from work and never came home. And after a while, the dinners went on the stove in a Pyrex dish. There were no Tupperware containers then. And then you take the Pyrex dish and put it in the refrigerator, and he'd come home 3-4 o'clock in the morning and demand a dinner, a fresh dinner, nothing left over. And as a good, dutiful wife, I'd get up and do it. I'm so ashamed to say that today. And, you know, it went on like that for a few months. And after about 3 months of being married, I says to him once, I says, Joe, you know, I really think we need a baby. At 19, I needed a baby. You know, I was lonely. I wanted a husband. I didn't have one because he had other things on his mind. And he says, I think we're too young for a baby. I says, let's just try once. There's no such thing as trying once. We went on to have seven babies. This program works. You know. And, well, anyway, 9 months later, we had our first child, a little girl named Debbie. And Debbie today is a grown woman. She's 47 years old. She's just wonderful. She's just like her dad. She's chip off the old block, you know. And, anyway, he stayed home. He took me to the hospital, came home, stayed home another 2 weeks, and then he got dry again and went back out. So we went on that merry-go-round. Then he came home one time, and after many broken promises, you know, I don't know if there's many Al-Anon people out here tonight, but the alcoholic, you know, every time Joe promised me something, I really, really knew in the bottom of his heart he wanted to do that. He really wanted to do that, and I understood that completely. But he could never accomplish it because something got in the way. And what was it that got in that way? It was John Barleycorn, and I know that now, but I didn't know that then. And I used to think it was me all the time, so that's why my self-esteem was so low. You know, I kept saying, maybe I'm not pretty enough. Maybe I'm not too thin, and I'm not thin enough. Maybe I didn't dress nice enough. Maybe my food wasn't good enough. All those terrible things. So the self-esteem goes out the window. And he came home after all these broken promises one night after being away for like 2 or 3 days in a row. And he stood in the doorway weaving, and he says to me, I know what my problem is, before I even opened my mouth. I says, yeah, what is it? And he says to me, it's New York. I said, okay, what would you like to do? I would do anything with Joe. I would go anywhere with Joe. He says, I'd like to move to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Now, you all know, but I didn't know. That was the beer capital of the world. And we moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And, of course, the drinking got worse. You know, I don't have to go down that long road, and it was his story. But it got worse, and we lived there for a year. We rented a house with option to buy, and we lived there. We loved there. We lost everything there. And it was only my mom. It was then I started coming out of the closet. You see, I was in the closet. I never told anybody what was going on in my house. That was an old thing from when I grew up as a child. We were told never to carry stories out of the house. So am I going to tell you stories about my husband that I'm just married to? Oh, no. I wouldn't tell anybody. So I never told anybody what was going on in my house. But at that time when I was so lonely and things were tough out in Milwaukee, I finally broke down and told my mom, and at that time I was 6 months pregnant with my second child. And my mom says, if you'd like, come back to New York and live, and I'll give you and Joe a room in my apartment. Mom lived in an apartment in the Bronx. And we went back, we drove back into New York, we put our furniture in storage. And it's funny that I say we put our furniture in storage because today my furniture is in storage. But it's not because I'm homeless, it's because I'm building a new home. And but my furniture is in storage. And I know today that I'll get my furniture back out of storage. That furniture that I left in Milwaukee in storage, I never got back. Because we came back to New York and we lived in my mom's a little apartment with my mom. And 4 months later, through the grace of God and a lot of prayers, and I'll tell you the prayers I said in those 4 months. I used to run down to St. Anne's Church on 149th Street and 3rd Avenue every day, and I'd light candles. First, I lit them to St. Patrick because Joe's mom was Irish, and I'd say, St. Patrick, if you get Joe to stop drinking, I says, I'll go to Mass every Sunday, and I'll light candles, and I'll do novenas. I'll do anything you want. Well, after a month, this guy didn't answer me, you know, and I was very impatient. I wanted answers, 1, 2, 3. So I says, well, I'll try St. Anthony because his dad is Italian. So I used to run down to St. Anthony and light the candles every day, and I says, St. Anthony, if you get Joe to stop drinking, I'll name all my children after you. And I was pregnant at that time with my second child. I had one little girl. I was pregnant with the second one. But that just goes to show you, you know, we're powerless over alcohol. Our lives had become unmanageable. I was insane. I had so much insanity in me. You know, the alcoholic may have had his problems, but I was also insane using saints as I didn't even talk to God anymore. The God of my understanding that I grew up with as a child, I had lost him in the years of early alcoholism. I stopped praying to God. Why? Because I didn't get everything I wanted or I thought that I needed. So I used the saints. But, you know, on January 1st, 1962, the miracle occurred. I always say to my sponsees today, don't give up before the miracle happens. The miracle happened. And my husband came home, and well, not came home, but he woke up after being out all night and in the hospital. And he says, I'm going to call Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you call them for me? You know, and he went down to the intergroup office that day. And from that day till the day he left to this earth, which is 10 months ago, he was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful to that, you know. And he went down and he came home and he told me he was going to go to a meeting that night. And when he left to go to the meeting that night, he asked me for money for car fare because it was up in the North Bronx, and we lived in the South Bronx. Money was tight in those days. $2 was a lot of money, but I gave him the $2 that I had. And he took a bus. We didn't have a car. And he took a bus, which I suppose he did. But I got a call about an hour and 15, 20 minutes later, and it was a man on the other end, and he says, is this Joan? I says, yes. He says, my name is Jean, and I'm from AA. And I'm Joe's sponsor. And I said, oh, he met his confirmation sponsor? I didn't know anything about a sponsor. So he says, no, I'm his sponsor in AA. He says to me, and have you got any booze in the house? And I said to myself, oh, my God, they're all going to come back here now and drink. Because I thought that this was Alcoholics Anonymous. They all drink, so they're all going to come back to the Bronx and drink in my house. And I says, yes, there is some alcohol in the house. He says, well, get rid of it. And you know what I said? Do you know how expensive that was? I mean, talk about insanity. It was there, and it was in me, you know. But Jean came back to the house with Joe that night, and they both came in sober. And Jean sat and talked to myself and Joe and my mom for about an hour and a half, 2 hours. And by the time it was time for Jean to go, I didn't want Jean to go. I wanted Joe to go. I wanted Jean to stay. Because he said such wonderful things about recovery. And he told us what it was, what it would be like if you have the willingness and you try to change your life. And I wanted some of that so bad. Here I was, isn't that sad, 25 years old. And I felt like my life was over. You know, I was due to give birth that month. It was January 1st, and I gave birth 26 days later to my firstborn son, Joseph. And when I woke up from delivering my son, there was Jean on one side of the bed and Joe on the other side of the bed, still sober, 3 weeks later. Wow, I was amazed. I was shocked. It was then I began to believe and have hope, you know, and that's something I think that us Al-Anon people, we give up so easily today. We're so frustrated, and we're really willing to give up that hope and that strength that we've gained from watching things a day at a time. We want everything to happen fast and quickly, but it doesn't happen fast and quickly, you know, so I'm grateful that I stuck around. But, you know, 3 months down the road, I was still arguing and fighting with Joe, and he was going out to meetings every night, and he was getting dressed every night. He was putting on, in those days, they wore shirts and ties to meetings and blazers. And, God, I was trying for 5 years of marriage to make him get dressed and shower and shave every night. But you people did it in a blink of an eyelash, you know, and I was angry at all of you. I was really angry. And then when he used to put on that foo-foo juice after he shaved, you know, that aftershave lotion, you know, that used to drive me crazy. That was like a beer can popping because it used to set me into a frenzy that I thought, well, he's telling me he's going to AA meetings, but he's probably going out with other women, you know, because there was no trust. Trust is also a very big issue in an alcoholic marriage. Trust takes a long time to get through. But, you know, I'm so grateful, like I said, I stuck around and watched that miracle happen. But 3 months later, we were still arguing and fighting and stuff. And I accused him one night as he was going to his home group. And he says, why don't you come with me? Tonight's an open meeting. Why don't you come with me? Had a new baby at home. I says, no. But he came home that night and he says to me, tomorrow night I'm going to take you out to dinner to the diner. And after dinner, we're going to go up to a meeting. I said, okay. All of a sudden, I felt special, like he cared for me because he was going to take me to a meeting. He was running out every night. And when women picked him up for a meeting, I was like a maniac. You know, when that car drove up and there was a woman in the car, I was crazy. I can honestly stand here and tell you that today. But Well, anyway, that night he took me up to the Westchester Square Group in the Bronx, and he introduced me to a man named Hank Wanamaker, and Hank called to his wonderful wife, Mary, and he says, Mary, and Mary came forward, and he was this little short, chubby, white-haired lady like I look tonight, and she had on a polka dot dress, and she says, my name is Mary, and come on, we're going to go downstairs to a meeting. And I says, what kind of a meeting? And she says, an Al-Anon meeting. I says, what's that? She says, that's for the families of the alcoholics. Well, all of a sudden, I felt, wow, they have a place for me. Maybe I can grow like him. Maybe I can do some of those things. I even thought maybe a man will pick me up in the car. I really didn't, but I just threw that in tonight for a laugh. I sat at that meeting that night, and there were three speakers, because that was 42 years ago. That was April 14th, 1962. Could you believe it, how the years pass and time goes? And Mike and Christine came up tonight, and they gave me an anniversary card. I says, we don't sell anniversaries in Al-Anon. We don't celebrate them. And they says, but you really should, you know. And I don't know. We don't do those things. But anyway, I went to that meeting, and I sat there, and I listened to three speakers. And by the time the second speaker spoke, I says to myself, Joe came down here ahead of me and told them how I'm acting at home, and now they're telling me that because they want me to join their club. I was so untrusting. Even in Al-Anon, I was untrusting, you know. But after the meeting was over, Mary came over and handed me a meeting list. It was 2 pages long, and she says to me, well, what did you think of the meeting, honey? What, do you have any questions? I says, yeah, what's the sponsor? She says, you got one, and it's me. And I want you to call me every morning at 7:30. I says, but I can't. I can't. I says, I have a little girl at home. I got to get off to school and a baby that I'm nursing. And she says, you have one free hand, use it. Pick up the phone and call me. Those were tough sponsors in those days. I needed that, though. And she told me what meetings to go to, and I gave her an argument about that I couldn't. She says, you just get there to that meeting, and somebody will take you home. There were many meetings I walked to because I wanted something. I was in Al-Anon about 3 months. You know, the first night I was there, they gave me service. I'm still a service person. I'm so grateful for that. Today, I have a couple of duties, and one of them is I'm Southern New York Assembly Area Chairperson. That covers all of Southern New York. That's a busy little thing to do all the time, you know. Carry on with those assemblies and those Area World Service Committee meetings. They can get a pretty hairy at times, and you want to pull your hair out. But you know what? Those are things that have to be done, and I do them. But my first job in Al-Anon was the greeter. I stood at the door, and I greeted everybody. And I was very happy doing that. I was very shy. You'd never know that today, that I'm very shy. But I was very shy. And 3 months later down the road, Mary says to me, next week you have a new job. I says, wow, they really know who they got here. I read that Al-Anon book they gave me. There was only one Al-Anon book, though, The Family of Alcoholics. And I read all those pamphlets they gave me. And I says, what job is that, Mary? I was so cutesy with her. And she says, next week when you come, you're going to be the chairman. I says, wow. They really know that I do this job well. And I went home that night, and when I got home, Joe was already home from his meeting, and I said, babe, what do you do in your group? So he says to me, what do you mean, what do I do? I says, what kind of job do you have? He says, Joe, you know I'm the coffee maker. I says, you're still the coffee maker? After 6 months, you are the coffee maker. And he said, yes. I says, well, they made me the chairman. You know, what we do when our head swells, we ease God out. And I had no humility. I was full of pride and arrogance, you know, and it talks about that in your book and mine. You know, and I had to get past that, but I wasn't working on it yet. I was working on competition here. And, that week, you know, I shopped around all week because I wanted to find a polka dot dress that looked like Mary. I says, if I'm going to be the chairman, I want to look like Mary. I even thought maybe I should dye my brown hair gray at the time, but I didn't, you know. But I never found that polka dot dress, even till today. My friend Tina told me that she was out in a store last night and saw some polka dot things. I said, so take me there. I still want to find that polka dot dress. You know, but I went up that next week, and I got there early. I got there an hour before time, and there was Mary waiting for me. And I says, oh, you came early, too. I'm so happy because you have to tell me what I read. Like John had that folder full of paper tonight. I wanted to be that chairman. I wanted to read everything. And she says, what are you talking about, dearie? I says, well, you told me I'm the chairman. She says, that's right. You see those chairs over there on that side of the room? She says, you can set them up in 10 across. Well, wow, did that ego shrink? But, you know, I never told Joe that story until like a year later. I wasn't ready to do that, you know. Like Dennis said to me today when I came up here, he says to me, you're going to tell the frying pan story. No, I neglected to tell the frying pan story. I just thought about it now because I thought about the head and Joe's head. And he came in one night demanding dinner at 3 in the morning. And I says, I have things left over in the refrigerator. Let me heat it. And he says, I don't want that. And he says, I want chili. You know, when you're drunk and you're at the table and your head is down all over the place and like that good, dutiful nun Al-Anon wife, I'm making him chili. And as I'm making it, his head is falling lower and lower into the table. And I just picked up that frying pan and hit him over the head with it. I went into a blackout. I mean, you guys talk about blackouts. Why not us? There's a lot of things I don't like to think about either, so I call it a blackout. And he fell asleep, you know, he didn't fall asleep. He went down dead drunk on the floor. But I went in the bedroom and got a pillow and put it under his head, and I took a blanket off the bed and covered him. And when he woke up in the morning on the kitchen floor and he was rubbing his head, I said, you came home like that. You see, that guilt sits there. Even though you go into a blackout, that guilt sits there within, you know. And I didn't share that amend with him until like 20 years later. Oh, God, this has been such a journey of fun. I'll tell you. But anyway, we went on, and I finally got myself straightened out. My sponsor was wonderful. She decided to do the steps with me right away. And if you have a sponsor, please use them. Please start on the steps and traditions of this program. You know, if you want to compete with your, and it wasn't even compete, if you want to keep up with your alcoholic, there's nothing like the gift of a loved one in the program of Al-Anon who goes along with you. I've been up here to these conventions for how many years with my spouse, holding hands, enjoying the weekend. In the beginning, my mom used to say, you two going away on a weekend again? Please don't come home pregnant. This was always her last words to us. We felt that was our primary purpose in life. You know, today I feel like my primary purpose is just to carry the message of Al-Anon. You know, we brought up 7 children in recovery. It wasn't easy. Today it's not easy to bring up any children. I see a little one nesting there on her mommy's, you know, chest. It's such a beautiful feeling to have them that close. But they don't always stay that close. My firstborn son had the disease of alcoholism, and I went down that merry road of alcoholism with him. You know, I knew what it was like to be the wife of an alcoholic. I never knew what it was like to be the mom of an alcoholic. And thank God for Al-Anon parent groups, because we have Al-Anon parent groups where you go and you sit with other parents who have children who have alcohol and drug problems. You know, it's all over today, no matter where you go. And I went there, and I had to stop being an enabler. I had to sit and listen. I had to say to myself, wow, I'm doing things all wrong. Even though I'm in Al-Anon for so many years, I'm doing things all wrong. I would slip him money. He would tell me, Mom, I lost my wallet on the Long Island Railroad 3 times a week. You know, but as a mom, you can believe them, and you want to believe them. You want to make them better, so you try to do all those things. And, you know, when Joe says to me, Joan, we're going to have to give tough love. And I says, oh, that's not an Al-Anon word. He says, what are you talking about? I says, I looked it up in my index in my books. It's not in any Al-Anon books. I can't do it. All of a sudden, I became so Al-Anon efficient that I wouldn't do anything unless Al-Anon told me, you know. And he says, well, you think about it. And like 3, 4, 5 months later, after I got sick and tired of being sick and tired, I decided to give tough love with my husband. It was a terrible night. It was a terrible time. I thought he'd be home the next day because he wanted a shower, but we couldn't let him in unless he stopped drinking and doing his thing, you know. My son lived out on the streets for 3 years, and he could have died, but we always have to remember everybody has a God in their life. And if we let go and let God and turn him over in a proper way, but keep ourselves busy. I'll never forget at that time, God was so good to me. Because 2 weeks after I put my son out along with my husband, I kept busy. I kept going to Al-Anon meetings. And I was at a service meeting one night, an Al-Anon service meeting at Intergroup. And I went out to go to the bathroom. When I came back, the chairman said, "Joan, do you accept this position?" And my sponsor was sitting there tugging my shirt. And she says, "Say yes." I says, "To what?" "Don't go down to the bathroom when you're having elections, you know." And she says, "You're the new CPCPI person, cooperating with professional community and public information." And what did that do for me for 3 years? It took me into hospitals, jails, and institutions. For 3 years, my son was out on the streets. I was so busy, you have absolutely no idea. Besides my nursing job at the hospital and having days off and having to go to hospitals, jails, and institutions and give meetings and get other people to come in, it kept me busy. But I used to love to go to the jails because I'd sit in there with the fellas with the orange uniforms and look all around the rooms and hopefully find my son. But I never did. I never did. I was also very happy that I was able to start an Al-Anon meeting in Nassau County Jail at the time for the women inmates, and they really loved it. So many of them were affected by the disease, not only in their four things they did during their alcohol, but they had other problems grew up with them. So service has been a wonderful, wonderful leader for me, you know. My son did eventually find recovery in AA, and I was grateful for that. And when he got sober, he went back to school and he became a registered nurse, just like me. 5 daughters and 2 sons, and my son became a nurse. Isn't that the greatest thing going? It's really wonderful. Thank you, God. But, you know, God decided that he needed Joseph, too. But my son had an asthma attack just 4 years ago, and he passed away. But he passed away sober, and I know he's happy. And he was just married 2 months at the time. And what a wonderful gift it was to share 9.5 years of sobriety with him. It really was a wonderful gift. And it was a wonderful gift for our children to see. Because at the time, when he was doing his drinking and his thing, I took my 3 youngest daughters to Alateen. My other 4 children all went to Alateen meetings when they were young. But the 3 youngest daughters went to Alateen so they could understand about the disease. We have a wonderful Alateen program for our children today. We even have an Alateen convention going. I think it's in August. This flyer is out on our Al-Anon table. And it helps the children to understand about the disease. You know, this is family disease. We in our family always believed in family recovery. That's why my husband was in AA. I was in Al-Anon. Our son finally made AA. Our children were in Alateen. What a wonderful gift this was. There is joy in the journey, but we have to work hard on it, and I'm so grateful that we continue to do so. And my primary purpose today is to continue to do so, that Al-Anon will be here for my children, my grandchildren, and whoever else comes down the road. You know, a year ago this month, we went into contract on a new house out in Suffolk County. We sold our home of 35 years here in Nassau County, and Joe and I decided to buy a retirement home. It was brand new. It was beautiful. It was a condo. We bought all new furniture. We were so happy, like 2 little kids on a log, you know? And they tell us in program, change is good. Change is good, so we were changed. And we moved in our house, and we were there for 3 days. In fact, Joe moved us in, and I was at a regional service seminar in Delaware the weekend he moved us in with our children, and I felt a little guilty, but 2 days after we moved in, we were going to Hawaii. We were in Hawaii last year at this time to speak at their Big Island Bash, and we were so happy. We had 16 days there with some friends of ours from program, and we had a wonderful, wonderful journey. And while we were there, we were on the island of Maui. We took this trip, this road to Hana. I don't know if any of you ever heard about this road to Hana. It's a beautiful, tranquil, serene place. And you go up and up and up. And all you see is the wonders of God. the wonders of God in nature, and waterfalls coming out of the mountains, and birds singing, and exotic flowers. It was beautiful. It was a long journey. It took about 10 hours. And we were on a bus with a lot of people, and some of the people were saying, wow, I can't wait to get to the road to Hana, to the top. Everybody was waiting to get to the top. Joe and I happened to be sitting in the front of the bus, and we were holding hands. We were like two little kids, you know. Here we are, 48 years married, still holding hands, still doing all these things. And Joe nudged me, and he says to me, they just don't get it, do they, babe? I says, no, I don't think so either, Joe. He says, the joy is in the journey. The joy is in the journey. It's not up at the top. It's right here as you're going through. And at one focal point, we got out, and we stood over this magnificent cliff with the water coming down and birds all around us chirping. And we were so silent, just holding hands. And I felt such a stillness and a calmness within me. And this was like April 13th when we were there. And this stillness and this calmness we felt. But when we got back to our hotel room that night and we were saying goodnight, he said to me, I felt so close to God today on that trip, on that road to Hana. I says, I did too, Joe, at one point. I felt as if God was standing there holding us both in his arms like he's done all these years. And it was the exact point of time that we knew. And we came home, you know, and 4 weeks later, Joe got up to go to the bathroom one night. He was due to speak in Kansas the next day. And he died in our new home. He fell asleep in the bathroom, and that was it. I tried to revive him, but I couldn't. I brought him back, but an hour later, he was gone. And it was a shock because he wasn't sick. But, oh, what a journey it has been. What a beautiful journey. I could stand here tonight, and I could tell you stories of heaven, not to make you sad, but of the wonderful life we've led, all because you helped to change the man that I love. You all helped to change him. You taught him about the steps. You taught him to take negatives and turn them into positives, to be a good husband, a good father, a good mentor, and he helped so many. And I'll be forever grateful that I married an alcoholic. You see, that's why I always say that. So today, my journey is still going on. I'm still complete. I have 9 grandchildren in my life today. And one I watch every day, little Sarah Elizabeth, who was a special gift to us. 3 months after my son passed away, Sarah was delivered by cesarean to my daughter and on my son's birthday, you see. And when she was given to her mother in her arms, her mother says to her, Sarah, welcome to our family. And did you meet Uncle Joe before you got here? So Sarah's special, and she's in my life every single morning. And today when I was leaving to come here, she says, Grandma, where are you going? And I says, I'm going to a convention. She says, is that one of your meetings? I says, yes, it is. She says, with those Al-Anon ladies? I says, yes, it is. She says, maybe when I get big, I could go too. So I hope if we keep carrying the message of Al-Anon and a good message, a positive message that our friends Lois and Bill gave to us, we too can pass that on to our children. I want Al-Anon to be here for my children, you know. I neglected to tell you that I too met Lois and Bill. They spoke at the first breakfast that we ever went to. We were just 4 months in program, and I said to my sponsor, Mary, who is that little lady up there? And she says, that's Lois. I says, who's Lois? She says, who wrote your book, dearie? Lois and Bill are wonderful people. So anyway, we have this wonderful thing, and we carry on. And I'm so grateful. My oldest grandson, Michael, is graduating from high school this June. And he's in the ROTC. He's a very gifted young man. He's very brilliant. And my son told me the other day that he says, Mom, he signed up to go into the Air Force right after a graduation. But he went, and they don't want to take him because he still has braces on. He's only 17. He has to have his braces off before they take him into the service. But he told his, whoever you sign up with, I'd like to stay home a few months and spend some time with my grandma. So you know what? Coming from a 17-year-old boy today, I feel very, very special. I feel very special. And when I got in the car today and I turned to go onto the Southern State Parkway to drive up here, I says, "Oh, Joe, I wish you were in this car with me right now." And I said it out loud. And as I made the turn, off the visor of my car, I have Joe's picture. And it fell right on my chest. I says, "Okay, I know you're talking to me." And then I turned on 106.7 and the song was playing, "I'll Be Watching You." So you tell me that God doesn't send messages. And I'll tell you, you're wrong. But Al-Anon has given me awareness. Al-Anon has given me the hope to go on, the faith to believe, the peace of mind to understand. Al-Anon has given me a wonderful life. Thank you, God, for Al-Anon, and thank you, Al-Anon, for God.
Thank you, Joan. I identified a lot with your story. I should try another program, too. Okay, our next speaker is a past delegate for CINI. I'll give you Paul S.
My name is Paul. I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank the convention committee, John, and all the people who worked with them for inviting me to speak tonight. I remember about 14 years ago, I was in exactly the same position that John is in. I had been working on conventions and had gotten to be the chair and was asked to introduce the speakers and really didn't know very much about introducing people. And I found that that experience was something that really affected me. I came to realize that here in AA, it's not how you do it really that matters. It's that you do it. It's that you do the best you can, and you do it to the best of your ability, and usually you do a pretty good job. John did a very good job. I'd also like to say a few words about Joe L. I was privileged to know him. And I feel a very great privilege in being able to speak at the same meeting with Joan. I don't think of Joan as Joan. I think of her as the bride, because that's what Joe always called her, the bride or my bride. I think I can speak for everybody in CINI in saying that Joe will be very, very much mourned. I shared a sponsee with him. One of my service sponsees was a recovery sponsee of Joe's. And so we got to go to a lot of meetings together and to talk with each other about things and to hear each other's stories. Perhaps he heard a little bit too much of my story. I was a person who was at the time as a delegate and was asked to talk a lot. Still talk a lot. And I got to know Joe. I got to respect him. I got to respect his sobriety. He was a person who worked the AA program. He tried to carry the message. Joe had so many sponsees, and yet when he went to a meeting and a newcomer walked into the room, he was among the first people to reach out, to shake their hand and say hello. I think that it's very appropriate for me to say at a welcoming meeting that Joe was a welcoming person to AA, and he will be very sorely missed. Let me talk a little bit about my story. I spent a large part of my life always thinking about myself as being outside, as being apart from, as being different. I always thought of myself as the person who didn't fit in. And I always had this picture of myself as the little kid I once saw in a movie with his nose pressed up against the glass of a store window looking in while everybody was shopping and having a good time and doing things, and he was out there on the outside. That was my image of myself. That was the way I felt about myself. I always thought of myself as apart and different. I grew up in a family where drinking was expected. When you got to be 16 or so, your parents took you aside, said, "This is where we keep the booze. You are welcome to it. Try not to get too drunk." And everybody expected that I'd get drunk. Everybody knew that I'd drink a lot because everybody in my family drank a lot. I knew that I was going to be a bit different, though. Again, that difference, that apartness. I was going to be the person who was going to be the sophisticated drinker. I wasn't going to be the fall-down drunk. I was going to be the person who, like William Powell in the Thin Man movies, was always drunk, but always able to be smart, sophisticated, witty, and solve the crime at the end of the movie. It didn't work out that way. I was fortunate in that I got a good education. I really think that my drinking started to progress when I went away to college. It was the first time I'd been away from home for any length of time. And there I found that alcohol was a relaxant. It was something that helped me to deal with people. It was something that helped me manage to relate to people. I was always shy, always tense, always really driven, I suppose. And so when I had a drink, I was able to talk to people. I was able to go to parties. I was able to deal with other people, to be a part of rather than apart from, to be one of the crowd, to be a person who participated. And that was important to me because of that constant sense of difference I had. That sense of difference became accentuated because at around that time I came to realize that I was gay. And I had grown up in a religion that was very conservative, and I struggled very much with that idea. It was something that later on I used as an excuse for drinking. If you were like me, you'd drink too. I grew to hate myself and to dislike myself and to try to hide myself. I was one of those people who, unlike the same, well, Joni used the phrase in the closet. Well, I was way in the closet. I was a person who used alcohol then to enable me to relate to people that I felt different from and whom I assumed would always feel different from me. So for me then, alcohol was that social solvent, that thing that enabled me to relate to people. And it worked that way for a while. When I graduated from college, I went to law school. And my law school career, as I see it, was a history of progression. I went into law school as a weekend drinker. I graduated from law school as a daily drinker. I went into law school never having had a blackout. I went into out of law school basically a weekend blackout drinker and a daily drinker who didn't blackout most of the time during the week. I'll tell you that when you're talking about trial lawyers particularly, let's put it this way. Joni called alcoholism a family disease. I think you might also call it a disease of a profession, a professional disease. There are a lot of us who are practicing lawyers who are not quite there in the morning. I came to realize that, and so after I graduated from law school and had a few years in practice, I decided that probably the best thing for me to be to go into law teaching. So I became a law professor. And if you thought I was in the closet then, well, now you know I really went into the closet because at that time, we're talking about 30, 35 years ago, the legal profession was not friendly to gays. And so I lived a number of lives at that time. I lived a life with my fellow workers. I lived a life with the lawyers that I knew socially, the people I'd gone to school with, and I lived a life with the people that I felt comfortable with and who were gay like me. I think that you could say that I had a heck of a time trying to keep those three lives separate and distinct. And when you're quite as heavy a drinker as I was getting to be, it's not surprising that those distinctions and separations started to collapse. I'm not going to go into details on that. Suffice it to say that there were a number of embarrassing situations. I still kept telling myself that I wasn't an alcoholic. After all, I had a home. I had a job. At the time, I was doing quite well as a law professor. I was a person who had a good income. On the outside, was a real success. But for me, really, alcoholism is a disease of the attitudes. It's a disease that says to us, somehow, you're not good enough, you're not a success, what you look like to others is something that you have to maintain as a facade because you're really not that good. You're really inside a weak failure. And so I led a double life in more than one sense. I led the life of a successful person who in the same time thought he was pretty, pretty poor. I continued drinking. I formed a relationship. Alcoholics probably should not go into relationships. We don't do it well. We tend to hurt other people and to get hurt ourselves. That relationship lasted for 8 years, and for a few of those years, it was one of those, what I think of as alcoholic, on and off, love-hate relationships, can't be with the person, can't be without the person, can't stand the person, but can't let go of the person. One of those situations where we'd break up one day, and then the next day we'd be back together again. Our friends got very sick of this because they never knew who they could talk to. And if they did talk to us and say anything negative about one of us, then when we got back together again, we'd tell the other one and, well, scratch that friend. It was a bad relationship. And as I said, eventually we broke up as a result of my drinking. Oddly enough, I had told him that I thought he should go to AA. And he did. And I got scared. I regarded his being in AA as a threat to me. I remember that's when I started hiding my drinking. That's when I started to pretend that the scotch bottle was actually full of scotch rather than water that I'd mixed in so that he wouldn't know that I was drinking. That's when I started to stay up late after he went to sleep so that I could have the three or four nightcaps that I needed. I eventually worked to undermine his recovery, and he quit AA. And we both started to drink even more, and as I said, we broke up. My drinking continued to get worse and worse. And whenever I tell my story, I prefer to think of the last 4 or so years of my drinking, when I still, on the outside, had a lifestyle that looked pretty good, but on the inside was not doing well at all. As I said, I convinced myself I couldn't be an alcoholic because I owned my own home. The ceiling of one of the rooms in that house had fallen in 2 years before I came into this fellowship. I was too busy to take care of that. The room of that ceiling was in was covered with plaster, and the rest of the house was covered with plaster dust. You couldn't see that too much, though, because of the dirty clothes that were scattered throughout the house. I was one of those people who did his laundry, or should have done his laundry every 2 weeks, and usually wound up doing it every month, so that I couldn't really put my clothes away because I'd have to go digging through the piles to find something that didn't smell too badly so that I could wear it until I was not so busy that I couldn't do my laundry. I had piles of cans and TV dinners scattered all over the place. I had such a mess in that house that it wasn't the mice that were a problem, it was the rats. I decided that I had to take care of that and had to do something about it, and I got a cat. Unfortunately, a drunk should not only have relationships, he shouldn't have pets. Cats do have certain natural functions that have to be taken care of. And I was not in a condition to take care of them. As I said, I was so busy that that poor cat, wandering around through the piles of dirt and garbage trying to find a place that was clean enough for him to use. He must have been very uncomfortable. Physically, when I look back at it, I was, again, a mess. I couldn't wear short-sleeve shirts during the summer because of all the bruises that I had all over my body. I was one of those drunks who could not walk a straight line when I went home. I lived in Brooklyn Heights. I don't know if any of you know that neighborhood, but it's got those bluestone pavings. Now, they look very chic and very 19th century and really attractive and all that. But when you're drunk, they're hell to walk on, particularly if a tree root has started to tilt one of them up and you're trying to walk and you don't notice that there's a 3-inch differential between the blocks. I hear Isadora laughing about that. She had the same problem I did. It's a situation where I fell down more than I walked home. And I frequently crawled home a lot more than I walked home. My body was covered with bruises as a result. Towards the end of my drinking, I decided that I was going to drink at home most of the time. Because every time I drank out of the house, there'd be some disaster. It wouldn't just be the bruises and the falling down and all that. You know, you can just lose so many wallets. You can just lose so many watches. You can just wake up outside your house because you weren't able to manipulate the key to get in. Even worse, you can only wake up so many times in a neighbor's house because you rang their bell at 2 a.m. asking them to put you up because you'd lost your keys. Was a situation where I'd really know that disasters were happening. This is something that happened in a blackout, so I'm not really sure exactly what happened. But one morning I woke up with a certain numbness in my leg, my right leg, and I found it difficult to walk. And after it persisted for a couple of days, I got a little bit worried and went to the doctor. And he told me that after he examined me and had x-rays and all that, that I'd ruptured 2 discs in my back. Now, that was in a blackout. I don't know how it happened, but I think it was when I fell down a flight of stairs while I was drinking safely at home. My life was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. I was losing friends. They couldn't put up with me. When I drank, I never knew what I'd be doing. I never knew whether I would be a friend and affectionate and friendly, or whether I'd be too affectionate, or whether I'd start verbally or physically assaulting you. There were so many times where I'd wake up the next day with a vague recollection that, gee, I've done something to so-and-so, and I'd call them up to find out what had happened, and I wouldn't get any explanation. I'd just hear a thunk as the phone would hang up on the other end. There were friends who got a little bit tired about getting the invitations to dinner and then showing up and finding that I had called them when I was drunk and had no idea that I had invited them. There were friends who got a little bit tired of the fact that when I did remember I had invited them to dinner, I'd find out that I'd forget that there was something in the oven because I'd gotten so drunk, and dinner would come after the smoke came wafting out of the kitchen into the living room, and I had to put together peanut butter sandwiches instead of the steak that we were supposed to have. It was more and more that I was not able to deal with people. I said that alcohol helped me to deal with people at the beginning. At the end, alcohol destroyed my relationships with people. It destroyed friendships. It destroyed a love of relationship. It destroyed my family relationship. Alcohol is a great breeder of resentments. And there was one brother I had who I didn't speak to for something like 6 years during my drinking, because he'd done something that I didn't approve of. Now, I was one of those alcoholics who would set standards that you were supposed to adhere to. I wouldn't tell you what those standards were, but if you broke them, you were out of my life. And that happened with that brother. Another brother I injured so badly, I don't want to go into details on that because it was very embarrassing both to him and me. But I hurt that brother very badly, and I was really remorseful about that. I really started to lose my family. My job was getting in difficulty. I mean, you can call in and say you've lost a relative and have to go to the funeral just so many times before they start wondering when you're going to run out of relatives. You can go into the office and say that you have to deal with paperwork and tell your secretary not to send any students in to see you while you're doing that, just so often before she starts to realize that the only paperwork you're doing is reading the New York Times. The life I was leading was getting worse and worse. My job, my physical situation, and all that were going to pot. That's another area I'm not going to touch. The fact is that my life was falling apart, and I couldn't recognize it. It got to the point where I was starting to believe that there were little men who were living in the walls, and I could hear them plotting to kill me. I could hear them whispering, and I'd go to bed with a knife to protect myself from them, or I'd lock myself in the bathroom so that they wouldn't be able to get to me. Or I remember this, leaving a shot glass of vodka on the mantelpiece so they'd go after that and leave me alone. It must have worked. They didn't get me. I still had really extreme denial. I could not convince myself that my life was really all that bad. And then one day, I had told myself that I was going to have one drink outside the house with one of the two people who still was willing to drink with me, and then go home because I thought that I was drinking too much and maybe I'd better be careful about drinking outside. I had that one drink and went into a blackout and woke up the next morning. I have no idea what happened, but I woke up with somebody else, and he gave me such a look of contempt and pity that I will never forget it. That was what I needed to decide that I was an alcoholic. I came to realize that I really had a problem. And suddenly, all of these things that have been going on came through to me that they're not what normal people, normal drinkers do. And I realized that I was either going crazy or I was an alcoholic. And I decided I tried AA because I didn't want to commit myself to an institution. And so I called that ex-lover, and he knew some people from AA. I had undermined it, but he still had contact with people. And he put me in contact with somebody who took me to my first meeting. I was a very lucky drunk. I went to my first meeting on October 9th, 1981, and I haven't had a drink since. I went to that meeting. It was the Ninth Avenue meeting. I'd insisted on being taken to a meeting that was predominantly gay because I didn't think anybody would understand me who wasn't gay. I was living in Brooklyn Heights at the time. Only thing I remember, there are a couple things I remember about that meeting. It was a third step meeting, and I remember that I was an agnostic at the time, and I was really uncomfortable. But I remember thinking that, well, some of these people say that they have doubts about God, so maybe that'll be okay. But most importantly, I heard two things. One was, you don't have to be alone. That was a revelation to me. In the last 4 years or so of my drinking, I was alone. I was isolated, separate, and all my life, as I said when I started, I was apart from. I always felt different and outside and unwelcome. And that here you were telling me I didn't have to be alone. You were telling me that I was welcome. The other thing that I heard at that meeting was that you don't have to drink today. And that was also a major thing for me because I thought I had to drink. I thought that alcohol was the only thing that was keeping me together. It was the only thing that was making my life worth living. It was my reward. I'd get out of work and get to that bar and have those three double martinis, and that was my release. That was what was saving me. I'd take that first martini and feel it go down my chest into my stomach and feel that warmth there. And then I'd feel it start pulsating down my legs and my arms into my toes, and I'd feel my toes curl, and I knew that I was home and safe and that alcohol was protecting me. So when you told me you don't have to drink, that was a revelation. That was something amazing and new. I didn't believe you, but I thought that since you weren't drinking, maybe it would work and maybe I should stick around and try it. And so I did. And I kept going to meetings. I said that I had a problem with the third step and with the God idea. I remember calling it the God thing. When I was about 3 or 4 weeks sober, I asked the man who took me to my first meeting to be my sponsor. Now, I'd gotten to know a little bit about him, but I didn't know what he did or anything like that. He seemed pretty sane and sensible and sober, though. So I thought I'd try him, and then I found out that he was a minister. I was very fortunate there because he did not try to push God on me. What he told me in dealing with the third step and the second step was, Paul, in your case, you don't really have to believe in God. What you have to do is believe that you are not God. He was right. I came to believe that there was something in these rooms that was keeping people sober. People like me who were inclined to drink. Something in these rooms that was working. I didn't know what it was, but I made whatever that thing was my higher power. It may have been just the group of drunks. I don't know. I did not come to accept the idea of an individual God until I had close to 10 years sobriety. You can get sober without believing in God. But I did believe in a power greater than myself. And that power greater than myself, I came to believe, was able to restore me to sanity. My sponsor also started one other thing with me. I remember when I had around about the same time that he told me about believing that I wasn't God, I came to him and complained. You know, when I first came into these rooms, you all made me feel very welcome. Everybody does that with the newcomer. They come up and they ask him how he's doing and all that. Unfortunately, when a person has 2 or 3 weeks, we sort of start to forget that he's still pretty new. And I came to my sponsor and complained, you know, people aren't talking to me anymore all that much, and I'm starting to feel like I'm not a part of things. And he said to me, well, maybe what you ought to do is get involved in service with a group. Maybe you ought to make coffee. Everybody talks to the coffee maker. I found out they do, usually to complain about the coffee. But they do talk to the coffee maker. And I started to feel like I was a part of that group. Again, you made me feel welcome through service. You made me feel that I was a part of and not apart from. You made me feel that I wasn't different and separate. You made me feel like I was one of the group. And I stayed involved in service for many years. I, as John said, eventually got to serve as the delegate from this area to the General Service Conference. Service to me was one of the real tickets to sobriety. It was one of my opportunities not only to get sober, not only to stay sober, but to live sober. It was a chance for me to learn how to relate to other people without the support that alcohol had given me when I was out there drinking, and which it had ultimately denied me when I was out there drinking. Eventually, I came to believe in a power greater than myself, that's a personal God. And when I rotated out of the position of delegate, I got involved in the church that I had joined. And I've been very busy with that church. That's sort of taken a lot of the time that I've had over the past few years. I've also had the opportunity. I remember I said that there was one brother that I had hurt very badly, that I had done things to that I don't even today want to repeat in public. That brother came down with colon cancer 2 years ago. I moved in with him and took care of him for a year and a half until he died last year. I was able to hear him say, "I love you, Paul." That is something that you have given me that I will always and forever be grateful for. The last words he said to me was, "Love you." That brother died last year, and I feel blessed that I had the chance to make real amends to him over that year and a half. The other brother that I had cut out of my life for 6 years, well, I spend a lot of time with him during the summers. And I've come to form a relationship with his family that I had never had before. So you've given me not only my life, not only my family, not only my God, but you've also given me something else. You've given me myself. I never had myself. I remember looking in the mirror and saying, "You something or other." why haven't you done it yet? It was commit suicide. I wanted to die, and yet I didn't have the guts to commit suicide, and I hated myself for that, too. You have taken that away from me and given me a sense of self-respect and self-worth that I never had. And remember, on the outside, when I was drinking, I looked pretty good, and I was pretty much of a success, but that never gave me self-respect or a sense of self-worth. You've given me that. You've given me me. Most importantly, and this I think is appropriate for a welcome meeting, you gave me a welcome. You made AA reach out to me, to be there for me. And for that, I am really grateful. I think that we tend to forget that that is our primary purpose, to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, whoever or whatever that person may be. I think all of us have felt at some time or other apart from or different from or outside. And AA has that wonderful message of making all of us feel welcome. Let's always try to remember that, even when we hear something that we don't like to hear. I remember I was in this convention about 8 or 10 years ago, and the topic of people who were cross-addicted came up, and at one of the meetings I said, please don't crucify us on your cross-addictions. I still believe that the AA program is about alcohol, and that recovery from alcoholism is our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. But let's not forget that that alcoholic who still suffers may be cross-addicted. Let's not use our primary purpose to defeat our primary purpose. Let's make sure that the hand of AA is always there for those who need it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.